I'd like to take a moment this morning to look at the book of Job, because it's something that comes up every year towards the end of the year, right after Thanksgiving. And it's a fascinating book. I've heard a lot of different classes on Job. It's amazing how many different ideas people have about it. I'm sure some of the things I say you guys will disagree with. That's fine. What I want to try to look at is the key point of Job and the prevailing ideology of the day that Job and his friends believed, and how Job struggled with that in relation to the suffering that had come into his life and trying to make sense of it, and what that led towards his feelings towards God and wanting to have like a day of court to show God that he was right. And I just want to look at that and also compare it to one of the humanistic philosophies that's been around for a long time. The Job's friends struggled with it, and it's something that can kind of seep into our mind too if we're not careful. So I think we're mostly pretty familiar with the background of Job. Let's just look at it real quick just to get to kind of set the scene. So Job chapter 1, verses 1 to 5 says, "There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was blameless, upright, fearing God, and turning away from evil. And 7 sons and 3 daughters were born to him. His possessions also were 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 female donkeys, and very many servants. And that man was the greatest of all the men of the east. And his sons used to go and hold a feast in the house of each one on his day, and they would send and invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. And it came about when the days of feasting had completed their cycle that Job would send and consecrate them, rising up early in the morning and offering burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, 'Perhaps my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts.' Thus Job did continually." And you can see what kind of man he was and the kind of family that he raised, and that they enjoyed spending time together. They loved each other and they loved God. And Job was so careful. They wanted to make sure there's nothing between his sons and God. They would offer sacrifices for him continually, just in case. And this is the kind of man he is, who, when Satan has risen up against him, the adversary says that, you know, yeah, Job, he only does that stuff because you bless him. But this is what God says about Job that time. He says in verse 8, "Have you considered my servant Job? For there is no one like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, fearing God and turning away from evil." Well, we know this story, how the adversary comes and says, yeah, that's right, he's that way just because you bless him. You take away those things, and then I'll curse you. So that happens. Everything's taken away back to back in a moment. And then again after that, they take away his health as well. And it happens so quickly, everyone must have realized it was an act of God. It came sudden destruction, swiftly, in all sorts of different manners. So Job is absolutely despondent this time, and his 3 friends come to visit him. Sometimes you can forget when we go through Job that they are his 3 friends, and they come down with good intentions, and you see what they do. You flip over, and when they see him, they don't even recognize him in chapter 1, verse 12. And it says there in verse 13, "And they sat down on the ground with him for 7 days and 7 nights with no one speaking a word to him, for they saw that his pain was very great." So you find out these are his friends. They came down with good intentions, but they end up being pretty bad comforters. So let's take a look at them. Eliphaz, I kind of see him as a leader of the group, and he's always looking to assert his authority and tries to almost say that what he has is divine. But you flip over to chapter 4, and we won't read the whole section, but from like 12 to 21, he talks about this vision. It says, "A word is brought to me stealthily, and my ear received a whisper of it, amid disquieting thoughts from the visions of the night, when deep sleep falls on men. Dread came upon me, and trembling, and made all my bones shake, and their spirit passed by my face. The hair of my flesh bristled up." He describes his vision that he had in the night. And the vision says, "Can mankind be just before God? Can a man be pure before his maker?" And he's trying to say, yes, what I'm saying is true, and here's this vision I had directly from God that backs it up. And I don't know what kind of dream he had, but it doesn't seem like that's the way God works. And his advice is pretty much refuted at the end of Job. So it seems like that vision was not exactly true. Which is another thing you have to be careful about with Job, is there's a lot of things thrown around and not all of them are true. You have to be careful who you're quoting from the book. And you also have Bildad, who we'll see. He's kind of the observer. He watches things. He looks at history and says, look, Job, you know, this is the way things are. Look around you. This is the way they've always been. Look back through history. Look at your parents' generations. This is what makes sense. And then Zophar, I kind of call him, he's like the Vulcan. He's logical and blunt, and doesn't really think about how his words affect your emotions. He's like, this is it, Job, you know. This is what you do. This is what you get. It's an equation. It makes sense. All you got to do is do A, and then you'll get B. And that's kind of what he is. We'll see you later on. So it's really cool. I want to talk about here, but if you actually go and read their speeches back to back, and you can really get a feel for the character from that. It's an interesting exercise, at least. But they all have a common theme. So I just want to read from the first round, just a couple of verses each, so we can see how they all kind of saying the same thing to Job. So in Job chapter 4, verse 7 to 9, this is Eliphaz, and he says, "Remember now, whoever perished being innocent, or where were the upright destroyed? According to what I have seen, those who plow iniquity and those who sow trouble harvest it. By the breath of God they perish, and by the blast of his anger they come to an end." And then over in chapter 8, look at Bildad. And he says in chapter 8, verse 6, "If you are pure and upright, surely now he would rouse himself for you and restore your righteous estate. Though your beginning was insignificant, yet your end will increase greatly. Please inquire of past generations and consider the things searched out by their fathers." And then we'll have Zophar over in chapter 11. He's kind of got a long section here. I'll just read really the whole thing from 13 to 20 is good, but I'll just read the first couple of verses of it. So Job chapter 11, verse 13. "If you would direct your heart right and spread out your hand to him, if iniquity is in your hand, put it far away. And do not let wickedness dwell in your tents. Then indeed you could lift up your face without moral defect, and you would be steadfast and not fear, and you would forget your trouble." So this is what they all believe, and this is what they come to Job with, is, "Job, what did you do? Put away your sin, turn back to God, and he will restore you. What did you do to cause this calamity that came upon you? What is it, Job?" And this was the prevailing thought of the time, that God immediately rewards the righteous and immediately punishes the sinner. And that theology seems to be something that's hardwired into our brains. It's there all throughout history. It's there thousands of years ago in the time of Job. It's still there in the time of Christ. You remember how Christ could not get his disciples to realize that the Pharisees were wrong because they were rich. Therefore, God must be blessing them. Do you remember what he said about the rich going through the end of the kingdom being as hard as the camel passing through an eye of a needle? The response is, "Then who can be saved? It's impossible. If the rich whom God is blessing can't be saved, then who can?" It's that theology that's around. It's around today in our modern times. Nowadays, Christianity in America, they call it the prosperity gospel, or word of faith, health and wealth, name it and claim it. And others, they simply call it karma. That's a big thing nowadays. And that one cracks me up because you see a lot of atheists talk about karma. And even though they won't believe in a God or higher power, they think there's some fundamental law in the universe that when you do good, the universe owes you good. And when you do bad, then it's going to give you bad. And somehow that's how they make sense of everything. And it's why, after rounds and rounds of debate, Eliphaz can still say this to Job over in chapter 22. Job 22, verse 21, this is what Eliphaz says. "Yield now and be at peace with him. Thereby good will come to you." And that's their philosophy. Like, as soon as you turn to God, he's going to bless you with blessings unfounding. And you wonder, why is this idea so prevalent? Why was it around then? Why is it around in the time of Christ, even though they had Job to read? And why is it around now in modern Christianity and in others? And I think there's a few possible reasons. Number one, it makes money. They can also call it baptized communism. Some of like the biggest mega churches and the leaders who write the best-selling novels, they're the ones pushing it because they say, money in, money out. You give us more money and God will give you more money. It works great. And it makes us feel good and gives you a sense of balance and justice to the world. Obvious right and wrong. Everything is just. Everybody gets what they deserve. So when God blesses us with goodness, we must be very righteous. We deserve that. And someone wrongs you today, they get what they deserve. And like all lies, it also has a basis of truth to it. Because the best lies are founded on truth, because they're hard to weed out that way. So let's look at a couple examples. In Psalm 5, you don't have to turn there, I'll just go ahead and read it. Psalm 5, verse 12. "For it is you who blesses the righteous man, O Lord. You surround him with favor as with a shield." And you get that kind of language a lot in the Psalms. And we know that God does bless the righteous, and he punishes the wicked. And also that sins have repercussions. 2 Samuel 12, verse 14. "However, by this deed you have given occasion to the enemies of the Lord to blaspheme. The child that was born to you will surely die." Remember, this is when Nathan confronts David after his sin with Bathsheba and the murder of Uriah. And David, when he's given that parable, says, "He'll restore fourfold." And that's what God requires of him. He restores fourfold from his sons, four of his sons. And that's a consequence of his sin. And people also, they mistakenly apply these promises to people as an individual basis when they're given to Israel as a nation. So know that Israel was told that God would take care of them if they did well, and that if they turned from him, then God would bring in outside forces to force them to turn back to him, and that he'd bring that disaster when they sinned. But it's national, not personal. One that gets quoted around a lot is Jeremiah 29, verse 11. And I think some people still apply it out of context. That's the one where it's like, I know the plans that I have for you, a hope and a future. And he's talking because in that same section, they're going to get taken to captivity in Babylon. He's saying, look, don't distress. It's going to be 70 years, but then I'm going to bring you back. There is a hope for this people. I will save the remnant, and I'll bring them back into the land when they return from Babylon. But we do have to be careful because that can seep into our way of thinking. Like how many times, especially you see your kids, because they tend to not have any filters on their mouth, and they'll just go, that's not fair. But how many times do we feel that ourselves? It's not fair. And then you have James 2, for time's sake, so we won't go into it. We know James 2, the beginning, where they talk about partiality, how you treat others. And what would happen if we had two visitors walk in this morning? You know, one has a nice suit and tie, and another is a homeless bum living on the street, kind of smelly, dirty beard, and he happens to see our sign, first he'll come in and check it out. How do we treat them? Would we treat them the same? We'd like to say yes, but probably not. At least not at first, like our initial judgment would not be. Maybe we'd realize after. But it's hard. It can be very hard, and if we're not careful, it can seep into our brains. So keep all that in mind as we look at Job, because this is what they were raised in. This was the belief of the times, and Job also had that belief, and now he's struggling to make sense of all that has happened to him, a righteous person, and how it fits in with everything he believes about how God works with people. This is a very difficult for him. In the midst of all his trials, he's also trying to make sense of what God is doing. And meanwhile, he's trying to do all this. His friends are convinced that he has a secret sin of which he needs to repent and turn back to God. So obviously, we can't look at all of Job for time, but I just want to look mostly at the first round of speeches and look at a couple points on it. So let's flip over to Job. And Job 5, we'll look at Eliphaz as his first speech. Job chapter 5, verse 17 and 18. He says, what is man that you magnify him and that you are concerned about him? Oh, sorry, I'm in the wrong chapter. Job 5:17. Behold, how happy is a man whom God approves. So do not despise the discipline of the Almighty, for he inflicts pain and gives relief. He wounds and his hands also heal. He talks about how you deliver them as soon as he turns. And you get again in verses 24. And you will know that your tent is secure, for he will visit your abode and fear no loss. And you also know that your descendants will be many, and your offspring is the grass of the earth. You'll come to the grave in full vigor, and the stacking of grain in its season. Behold this, we have investigated. Thus it is. Hear it and know it for yourself. And he's just spitting out, this is what they thought at that time. And so Job's still trying to figure this out, and he's attacked by his own friends. So how does he respond? He's a bit sarcastic here, as he knows in a few times. He says there in verse 1 of the next chapter, oh, that my vexation were actually weighed, and laid in the balances together with my iniquity. And this was his honest thought at this time, as he wants some time to speak with God and make his case and find out what exactly is going on. You get that again in verse 14. For the despairing man, there should be kindness from his friend, lest he forsake the fear of the Almighty. He's not getting any kindness from his friends. And in the same chapter, verse 29, desist now, let there be no injustice. Even desist, my righteousness is yet in it. Is there injustice on my tongue? Cannot my palate discern calamities? Saying, look, there's no secret sin. Desist from what you're saying. I'm trying to figure this out. I need to speak to God and hear what is he doing with me. I need to plead my case to him. And this becomes like the backbone of Job's argument as he rebukes his friends. And so he asks God, why is this happening? Over in chapter 7, verse 20, he says, have I sinned? What have I done to you, O watcher of men? Why have you set me as your target, so that I'm a burden to myself? Why then do you not pardon my transgression and take away my iniquity? For now I'll lie down in the dust, and you'll seek me, but I will not be. But of course, his friends don't see this, and so they begin the escalating debate that we know and read every year, where the three repeat their philosophy over and over again, and Job gets more sick of it, and more self-righteous as he defends himself, and they go more on the attack, attacking him personally. And as the debate goes on, that's just how they get. They're convinced there's a sin he committed and how wrong and stubborn he is. And he starts getting more defensive and self-righteous. And he's looking for a chance to defend himself before God and explain his circumstances until eventually he's driven to say that he must be right and God must be wrong. But originally, his desire to see God in court is, it makes a lot of sense. He lays it out pretty clearly. Job 9 does that a lot. We'll just read, you get that a lot in like the very beginning. Like he says, in truth, I know this is so, but how can a man be right before God? If one wished to dispute with him, he could not answer him once in 1,000 times. But he still wants his chance. You get there like in verse 23. It says, if the scourge kills suddenly, he mocks the despair of the innocent. The earth is given into the hand of the wicked. He covers the faces of its judges. If it is not he, then who is it? And he's saying, look, this philosophy you're brought up with, it's not working. Something doesn't fit. When the righteous suffer, when the wicked are lifted up on high, if God's not doing it, who is? And he doesn't understand why this is happening. And so he keeps continuing that thought. And so far, we've already read his response in chapter 11. He goes and says, you know, the logical solution is obvious. Turn to God and all your troubles will go away. And then in chapter 12, this is where you get Job's really sarcastic response. He says, truly then you are the people, and with you wisdom will die. For I have intelligence as well as you, but I am not inferior to you. And who does not know such things as these? I am a joke to my friends, the one who called on God and he answered him. The just and blameless man is a joke. He who is at ease holds calamity in contempt, is prepared for those whose feet slip. The tents of the destroyers prosper, and those who provoke God are secure, whom God brings into their power. And he's saying, look what's happening here. I am the righteous man, I am the blameless one here, and I'm turning into a joke while the wicked prosper. It just doesn't make any sense. And he continues it on in the next chapter in verse 3. But I would speak to the Almighty, and I desire to argue with God. And that's what he wanted to do, to lay out his case. And then he gets tired of defending himself to his friends. And really, he wants to take his argument directly to God. Because he says his friends' arguments over in verse 12 there, he calls them defenses of clay. Because they just keep repeating the same thing with nothing to back it up. And now that's a good thing for us to know. When someone is suffering, and we want to be a good friend and not be like Job's friends who are good friends but really bad comforters, remember, no platitudes. Don't go spouting those things at them. It's not going to help. But Job still has his trust in God. He believes God will vindicate him once he makes his case. So he continues on, and still in chapter 13, verse 18, he says, behold now, I've prepared my case. I know that I will be vindicated. So his trust is still in God. It says, in verse 22, then call and I will answer, or let me speak, and then reply to me. It's like, as soon as I can talk to God, I know I will be vindicated. I'll make my case, and God will realize that something is not right. And I'll say, oh yeah, that shouldn't be happening to Job, and then he will bless me. I just have to talk to God and make my case. And it comes up again in chapter 19. Chapter 19, verse 21. He's talking to his friends. Pity me, O you, my friends, for the hand of God has struck me. Why do you persecute me as God does and are not satisfied with my flesh? And he's realizing there's something very wrong with the way everything works. And finally, he starts to look beyond himself and saying, all right, you keep saying to look at our parents' generation, to look at how everything is. I'm looking at how everything is, and this doesn't make sense. And he gives chapter 24, which is a great chapter to show really what something a lot of people struggle with when they struggle with all the injustice that goes on in the world. Why do the righteous suffer? Why are the poor and needy pressed down? Why is there suffering? And that's something that people have struggled with through generations and generations. And that's what Job comes up here. In chapter 24, he starts out, why are times of judgment not stored up by the Almighty? Why do those who know him not see his days? And he goes on and lists all these things that happened, all the injustices that he has seen in his life. He's saying, look, Bildad, here's history for you. This is what happens and always has happened. Look around you. The righteous are not always blessed, and the wicked are not always condemned. Look at what happens. They take away the widow's ox. They push the needy aside. They the poor, they spend the night naked without clothing. They cause the poor to go about naked without clothing. They take away the sheaves from the hungry. And that those who rebel, they do not know its ways. A murderer arises at dawn. He kills the poor and the needy at night. He's like a thief. He just goes on for the whole chapter looking at all the wrongdoing as it happened. It says, look, they're happening to the righteous and the wicked. Everybody is suffering. And why? It just doesn't make sense. And that's kind of what its conclusion is. And this goes on and on about how the righteous suffer and are oppressed. And this goes on until Elihu enters the scene. So I'll try to wrap it up pretty quick. But Elihu, he comes in with a different theology. And his introduction is pretty great, and it's pretty memorable, because he comes in burning with anger in Job 32, in verse 1 through 3. And he's burning with anger against Job and his friends. And what you find out is his message is different. In chapter 33, verse 17 to 18, this is what he says. It says, that they may turn aside from his conduct and keep men from pride. He keeps his soul back from the pit and his life from passing over into Sheol. And this is about God giving instruction to men. He's saying, look, Job, it's not just about you and getting what you deserve. What about if you're going down a wrong way of thinking, and then God brings in suffering to change that before you even commit a sin, before you even go down that path, he's changing people. And then he goes on more than that. He says that God can work to prevent sin before it happens, and suffering can be to steer you away from a path you may have started to walk down, and that it can affect others as well. And he goes through the creation and shows how God really does not work that way, and instead he has a much higher plan. You get that over in chapter 35, verse 4. He says, I will answer you and your friends with you. Look at the heavens and see, and behold the clouds, they are higher than you. If you have sinned, what do you accomplish against him? And if your transgressions are many, what do you do to him? If you are righteous, what do you give to him? Or what does he receive from your hand? Your wickedness is for a man like yourself, and your righteousness for a son of man. Saying, look, whether you're righteous or a sinner, why is God going to go and change the way he's doing through you right then? Are you doing something to him? No, God's ways are higher than your ways, and he has a plan, and that's what he's sticking with. And he brings Job around to a different way of thinking. And this is very necessary, because when God enters a scene, or his angel, Job doesn't go and start fighting him like he's always wanted. He finally gets his day in court that he's been asking for, and he doesn't really say a word. Because Elihu's bringing him around to this different way of thinking. He's finally raising Elihu, this makes sense. This is the key point I was missing. And so God comes in chapter 38. And I'll kind of skip it for time's sake, but he goes through and talks about how his ways are higher. And people mistakenly think that God is just saying that he's powerful, therefore he can do what he wants. But it's not. It's about Job. Look, there's something you're not understanding here. You got to look beyond yourself. Are you the one who's developed the world? Do you develop the ecosystems? Do you want to treat every deer fairly? Then what happens to the wolves if they can't eat? And so it doesn't work that way. You have to manage everything. And that's why Job would never have realized, like in Habakkuk, in the daily readings, we've gone through Habakkuk. And in the beginning of Habakkuk, he says, look, he's saying to God, why do you ignore the violence that's going on in the city? Why are you not punishing the wicked of your people? And then in God says, all right, I will. I'm going to bring in the Chaldeans, and we're going to go take them out. And Habakkuk's like, wait, you can't do that. What? Like, that's his plan. You don't realize the suffering that's caused in order to save the remnant. And that's God's plan. And we have to understand this before the suffering happens to us, because if we try afterwards, it's going to be too late. Otherwise, we can lash out and say to God, you know, what did I do to deserve this? Why, God, why? And that's what a lot of people struggle through with loss and suffering. And it happens again and again. So just to start closing, I want to look at James chapter 1. James chapter 1, and starting at verse 2. He says, consider all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces endurance, and let endurance have its perfect result, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. But if any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask of God, who gives to all men generously and without reproach, and will be given to him. And this is wisdom to understand your suffering. And he says to count all joy, but you know that's difficult, as we find out later in Hebrews. But it has a purpose to it. And if you don't understand, pray to God that he would help you understand your suffering, which is what Job was going through. That was his goal, to understand why and what was happening. And it's a chastisement, not a punishment, in order to change people. And again, over in Hebrews, chapter 12, just flip a couple pages back, starting at verse 5, it says, and you have forgotten the exhortation which is addressed to you as sons. My son, do not regard lightly the discipline of the Lord, nor faint when you are reproved by him. For those whom the Lord loves, he disciplines, and he scourges every son whom he receives. For it is for discipline that you endure. God deals with you as with sons. For what son is there whom his father does not discipline? And again in verse 11, all discipline for the moment seems not to be joyful, but sorrowful. Yet to those who have been trained by it, afterwards it yields a peaceable fruit of righteousness. And that's what Job finds out here. And that's why it is recorded, both for us, to help us understand suffering and how God works. Job went through it and went through all the thought process so that we don't have to, and so that Jesus didn't have to either. Because that prosperity gospel really falls apart when you look at the life of our Lord Jesus Christ, who had no guilt or iniquity in him. He lived a life of self-sacrifice. His brothers rejected him. His disciples didn't understand, and they just wanted to be made greater. But through all his sufferings, he never blamed God through the trials, and he looked forward to the joy that would come, because he learned the lesson from Job, and he never had to go and try to argue his day in court with God, because he understood why God was doing all this. So now, as we take these emblems, let's remember our mentor and try to live the life he has called us into. And when we do go through suffering, even though it's not joyful in the present, to try to understand what is God trying to teach us and others through it. What is the purpose? So I'd just like to close with 1 Peter chapter 2. First Peter 2, starting at verse 19, in the context of being the slaves suffering under unjust masters. It says in verse 19, "For this finds favor, for the sake of a conscience toward God, a man bears up under sorrows and suffering unjustly. For what credit is there if you sin and are harshly treated, you endure it with patience? But if when you do that what is right and suffer for it, and you patiently endure it, this finds favor with God. If you have been called for this purpose, since Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example for you to follow in his steps, who committed no sin, nor was any deceit found in his mouth. While being reviled, he did not revile in return. While suffering, he uttered no threats, but kept entrusting himself to him who judges righteously. And he himself bore our sins in his body on the cross, so he might die to sin and live to righteousness. For by his wounds you were healed." Thank you.